couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films, The Rental, The Big Ugly, Baby Splitters, and Retaliation. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup, featuring a spotlight on Scoob and a look back at the original Poltergeist. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news is everything has moved. At the beginning of the week, Warner Brothers finally flinched and moved Tenet out of August, and it's been moved to an indeterminate slot, which does not pose well for the reopening of theaters, because they're like, we don't know when it's going to show up again. Now, the one thing you can hold on to is the fact that I don't see this thing ever going to VOD first. It's going to get a theatrical release. We just may not see it for another 9 months because they took it as tentatively off the schedule. Now, one of the things they have said they're going to do with this is maybe release it overseas, because overseas in some countries, they don't have the spiking of infections that we do here. And so they might release it there and kind of just piecemeal it throughout. They might also release it in America in states that are not affected by heavy spiking, or some sort of a roadshow thing. It's all indeterminate, but I'm confident that Tenet is not going to be going directly to VOD anytime soon. It's going to have its full release, but they're struggling to try and figure out a way to do this and make the money they need. They need hundreds of millions of dollars from this movie, and you're not getting that in theaters right now. The next release in that schedule was Disney having to flinch. They've been playing chicken, Disney and Warner Brothers, between Mulan and Tenet, and then Mulan. They flinched with Mulan, and they did a very Tenet-type thing. Mulan has been postponed indefinitely. We don't know when it's going to show up. We don't know if they're going to drop it into Disney Plus at some point. I don't expect them to. They may do that in the States if they finally say, hey, we can release it overseas and make the money. A lot of it depends on infection rates around the States and around America and how soon it takes us to get this under control when other countries have. So they're looking at that. You might see that happening more and more where the theatrical releases go international and we just get them on demand here in the States. Now, along with Mulan, Disney adjusted all their movies. I mean, even stuff that aren't coming out for years, they've taken all the Avatar sequels and they shifted them 1 year. They took the Star Wars movies that were going to, the new ones that like Taika Waititi is going to be working on, they shifted that for a year. The only thing that's still on the board is the New Mutants, which I think they're just going to want to release into whatever theaters they can and probably do an on-demand playthrough type thing, and then they'll drop it on Disney Plus. I think they want some sort of theatrical release, but they know they're not going to be making hundreds of millions of dollars on that. And then other releases started shifting in the schedule. Then outside of Disney, you had that Unhinged movie with Russell Crowe. That's been moved to, I think, September 1st. Bill and Ted Face the Music is going to stay in September, but it's going to be a day and date VOD and theatrical release. I think you're seeing that for movies that don't need the multiple hundreds of millions of dollars a box office, they're going to do a hybrid model. But the big movies, not just in Disney, but stuff like A Quiet Place 2 and Top Gun Maverick, those things got moved this week to 2021. At the same time, theaters are scrambling and saying, oh, please, please release the blockbusters. I mean, you had Regal delay its opening. You had Cinemark delay its opening. AMC wants to open their theaters, but you got to deal with any sort of local lockdowns or stuff like that. So this is going to be going on for a while. That's just the way it is. I know people have been hoping to get movies back, but we haven't been taking care of the infection rates, and they're going up, and the death tolls are going up, so they're wanting to kind of dial all this back. The next piece of news is more a response. I got an email this week, and I had to laugh at it, because it came from, and I'm just going to identify him. The person's name was Keith. And he insists that he's not going to listen to the show anymore. So I'm assuming I'm not responding to him. He basically complained, and I'm not going to read your whole email because he kind of rants a bit. But one of the things he said, he goes, the format recently opens up with a preachy soapbox message on the current situation on the country, RE COVID and the Antifa BLM riots. Well, okay. Now I have to pull back and say, there's a lot to unpack here because I don't think I've ever uttered the words Antifa on this show. I'm just talking about protests and I'm talking about the coronavirus and I don't even talk that much about the coronavirus, just like what I talked about in the last news story that masks need to be worn and you need to socially distance. Because if you want things to come back, you kind of have to do this stuff to reduce the spread. I talk about masks a lot because it's somehow become a political thing, but it's not political. I mean, heck, I just posted on my Facebook page this article about how the science behind masks is becoming more and more strong, saying that it works to help the spread of the disease. And that article comes from, you know, that liberal rag, the Wall Street Journal. So that's the point. I mean, I don't think that that's a political statement. And in regards to the protests, I don't think I even really talked much about them. I said, here are some movies to watch in light of it. We need to understand what's going on. We need to look at what people are saying. You get that many people upset and that many people protesting, I think it's important to listen to what they say. And then, of course, I covered that special 8 minutes and 46 seconds, which was Dave Chappelle's special. And, you know, I mean, he's kind of all over the political map. And like one of the things this guy said in the email, he goes, after all, it's still a free country, at least until Antifa and the cancel culture of the left, of which you belong, take control of the country. And again, I'm like, when he brings up cancel culture, I've talked about certain things in cancel culture. I've talked about not censoring cartoons. I've talked about not censoring Holiday Inn. I talked about, you know, you don't get rid of Gone with the Wind. You don't get rid of Birth of a Nation. But I think it's important to see that, to see where we were, what was considered acceptable at the time and how things have changed. And I think that that gives a nice way to look at stuff in a historical context, because history is reflected in the pop culture, and that's not cancel culture. I'm sorry. I mean, like, you've got something like the Cosby Show. I'm not even saying to get rid of the Cosby Show, but it makes it hard to watch a movie about a Family Guy who, you know, is out there drugging and raping women. So, you know, yeah, it's not that I say get rid of the Cosby Show, but it's not easy to watch. So that's the closest I get to any sort of level of cancel culture. So, you know, I'm sorry you're not listening, Keith. You know, you come back if you want to, but I don't think I'm being overtly political in this segment anyways. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That song means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is actually already out, I discovered. It's on Amazon Prime. I saw this trailer show up, and I wanted to talk about it. I've been kind of distracted this week from something going on in my personal life. I'll tell you more about it next week. But let's look at this Murder Manual trailer, because it stars Emilia Clarke.
Mama said you're going to die today.
You don't see the sign? You don't see the sign behind you?
This one, like I said, it's on Amazon Prime. It's not getting great reviews. I may watch it, but I just thought it was an interesting movie. I'm a big fan of anthology horror films. The next one I want to talk about is Possessor, which comes out soon, either in theaters or on demand.
Interface is active and we're at full power.
What's your levels this time?
You just make sure you pull the trigger on the way out.
After initial binding, you'll be locked in, with no loss of control permitted during this performance.
We can't afford any mistakes on this one.
Ready?
This is directed and written, I believe, by Brandon Cronenberg, who's the son of David Cronenberg. So, of course, he's using the good juju of his father's name to do it, and it looks like it has some ties to stuff like Videodrome, maybe not specifically tying it to those movies, but he's certainly trying to give a movie that would fit in the wheelhouse of his father. So this looks interesting, but, you know, it's still a little untested. We'll see. That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Big Ugly and Retaliation. to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews for this week and talk about The Big Ugly. This is actually coming out in theaters. I actually have a list. I've been sent a list of theaters that it's coming out in. So it's coming out in various cities. So if you can hear me on the radio, check your local listings. You're not find it in your multiplexes, but you're going to find it in drive-ins. You're going to find it in brick and mortar theaters that have opened if the local health departments allow that to happen. So this is actually a bona fide release in major markets. And in this film, a London criminal travels to West Virginia to launder money, but seeks revenge when a local crime boss's son kills his girlfriend.
Back in London, Harris is the top man. But here, deep in the hills of Appalachia, Harris has a mate, an oil man, Preston.
Look at you.
So here we are, invested in an oil operation.
Fiona's dead.
She was sitting right there with Preston's boy.
You're looking for answers.
Don't do it.
This is directed and written by Scott Wiper, and I actually have a history. I know Scott. I actually worked on a movie of his, just for full disclosure. I worked on a movie of his called A Better Way to Die back 20 years ago or something like that. And I've interviewed him before. He did The Condemned, which also stars Vinnie Jones. Vinnie Jones is the main guy in this one. He's got a really good cast in this. Like I said, Vinnie Jones, Ron Perlman's in it. You've got Malcolm McDowell's in it. Bruce McGill is in it as sort of a henchman. You'd recognize Bruce McGill. He's in a ton of stuff, but he's not a well-known name. But this is very typical of the stuff I've seen from Scott before. He did some movies that came out in theaters. Like he did that movie, The Condemned, back in 2007. And he did that movie, was it The Cold Light of Day? I think that had Henry Cavill and Sigourney Weaver and Bruce Willis. He has also done a lot of direct-to-video stuff. Like, there's a series, and it's not the one with John Cena, but there's a couple series of wrestler action movies that have gone on VOD and direct-to-video type releases. He's done a couple of those. He always does sort of these gritty action films, and he does them well. I like to point that out because I think in general, Scott works really well in this wheelhouse he's built of crime action films that are kind of low budget, either for VOD or day and date releases like this. Not something that's going to get a huge release, but he enjoys doing this, and his movies certainly have that gangster attitude to them. Now, with that said, this movie itself, I'm not a big fan of. There's other movies that Scott Wiper has done that are better, and including that Cold Light of Day movie that kind of came and went, nobody cared about. That's not a bad little action flick for an international thriller. You know, he may actually, can I come to think of it, I think he may have just written that one. But you have to kind of like that kind of, you know, gritty, tough gangster, you know, pummeling each other. But kind of all his movies still take place. He's from Ohio. He's from Central Ohio. So it's, you know, he's up past Columbus. You start going into the foothills of Appalachia as you start going into West Virginia. So yeah, this is a, you know, this is close to the area that the writer and director started from. Now, I like Vinnie Jones as an actor, and I think it's great to see him as the hero in a movie. He always plays a heavy. He always plays a bad guy or a henchman, and it's nice to see him carrying a movie. The problem with this is it's just, I don't care about any of the characters. And that's always a sticking point for me. If I can find something charming or lovable about the actual characters in the movie, like saying, oh, I could go have a beer with that guy, that will take me into some of the worst places you can go in an action movie. I just didn't like the characters. I thought some of them were underdeveloped. The son of Ron Perlman, who's the bad guy, he's the guy who Vinnie Jones's character is going after for revenge. He's okay. He's kind of like a low rent Dan Stevens and doesn't quite work as a formidable opponent. And Ron Perlman's good in it. Malcolm McDowell's good in it. I think they hold their own. But, you know, just sort of the main characters of this, because they also have these other characters that are meant to be like the younger heroes, but it's not their story. And if you want to make it their story, make it their story. But then it keeps jumping back to Vinnie Jones. Look, I like murder revenge stories. I just didn't feel that this had the oomph and the power that you need for a murder revenge story. So unfortunately, I'm going to have to say this kind of sucks, but it's out there if you like that kind of thing.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is Retaliation. Orlando Bloom plays a demolition worker who targets a local priest for abusing him earlier in life.
I keep having this dream. Not really a dream, it's a nightmare.
I went to mass here when I was a kid. Didn't you go to church here too?
Forgive me, Father, for I've sinned.
What would you like to confess?
I have to hurt someone severely.
What are you here for?
Revenge.
It's interesting. I've seen Orlando Bloom in a couple movies lately. He was in that movie, The Outpost, which was Rod Lurie's film. It came out right around 4th of July. The one about the impossible to defend outpost. And it's nice to see Orlando Bloom doing something different than Will Turner or Legolas. And I know he's tried. He's done a lot of movies. And aside from those major ones, the franchise films, nobody really knows him from anybody else. He's kind of never broken out outside of the fact he's lucked into a couple huge franchises. And he does a fine job acting, but, you know, sort of like The Big Ugly, I didn't like the characters. The whole point is that his character was abused by this priest. And that's given him a very difficult time because, you know, of course he's devoted to his mother and she still lives in town. And he wants to take care of her, but she's pious and she doesn't want anything to be said about the church. I think it actually deconstructs some really interesting details about the abusive priest situation from the point of view of the victims, you know, as opposed to something like Spotlight, you know, the Academy Award winning movie that looked at the uncovering of that rather than, you know, the effect it can have on the actual people and how it can affect them, you know, when people don't mean to put that person into more abuse, but end up doing it anyways due to tradition or fear. So I think it has some interesting stuff to it. It's just, again, like the character's not that good. Janet Montgomery plays his girlfriend, and I'm a big fan of Janet Montgomery. I noticed her in pretty much anything she shows up in. It's just she's not given a whole lot to work with. There's not a whole lot of depth to her character. Because the same thing happens in The Big Ugly. They have, Raven Levin, or I think is her name, plays this pretty bartender who's involved in this group of people. And they're fine, but kind of like the only thing that's interesting about them is they're pretty and they're somebody's girlfriend. There's really no depth to those characters. They don't develop them that much. And that becomes a real problem because you want to see movies about well-developed characters. And while there's a lot to deconstruct with Orlando Bloom's character, not a whole lot of that happens. The most interesting stuff happens in like the last 15 minutes of the movie, but it's not enough to kind of get over plodding through the rest of it. So it actually was released, I believe, in the UK and overseas in Europe under the name Romans, which is in reference to a Bible verse. But this one, it's called Retaliation. But I'm going to have to say this one kind of sucks as well.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Rental and Baby Splitters. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into more movie reviews and let's talk about The Rental. Dave Franco's directorial debut sees two couples sharing a rental house only to discover they might be the subject of voyeurism and violence.
Charlie! Tell me that's not a camera.
Get through the night. We leave first thing in the morning.
What's going on?
I don't know.
Soon, I promise.
This will never be over.
Look, this is not okay, Charlie, all right? Stop being so calm.
Everything is fine.
One of the things that has been promoted a lot is this is Dave Franco's directorial debut. And if you don't know who Dave Franco is, he's James Franco's younger brother, but he's built a career for himself. He's not just riding on his brother's coattails. I mean, yeah, he was in The Disaster Artist, which his brother directed, but he did a good job in that movie, but he's been cast in a whole bunch of different things. He does comedy. He's done more serious stuff. I think he got one of his starts. He was in the last season of Scrubs, but he's done a lot of stuff, but he's most known for acting. He's worked with his brother several times, but he's also acted bona fide having a career outside of it. But he's doing this thriller. It's a horror movie thriller type thing. And it's his directorial debut. Now, he works a little bit with like Joe Swanberg, I think, is involved in it. And that's the guy who I think he was involved in like Your Next and Sacrament or something like that. But Dave Franco co-wrote the script and he directed this. And it shows he's got a real knack for directing. Because he doesn't overplay things, he doesn't over-sensationalize it, and he takes his time, and this works as a suspense movie. Now, there's a certain similarity to that Kevin Bacon movie that came out a couple weeks ago or months ago called You Should Have Left, only it doesn't have a spiritual component. This is all very down-to-earth and pragmatic. And now, you know, depending on who you are, sometimes people find a movie scarier when it involves something you can't see, like a ghost or goblin or demon. Or something that's not real. There are some people who that doesn't get scary to them because, like, you know, vampires don't exist. But a movie that can really happen does scare some people. And that's something that The Rental absolutely works on. It's something that's going to make you think twice before you go booking some sort of Airbnb type thing. It really is that it could happen. But it also relies on, you know, sort of a staple of horror movies being, if the people weren't as stupid as they are at times, if the people don't screw up and aren't as careless, it wouldn't have gotten as bad. But the fact that these people kind of make their own graves, so to speak, at least two of them do. At least there's a certain comfort in watching a movie like that because I'm like, well, I would never do something that stupid. Don't get me wrong. I've done plenty of stupid things in my life, but I would hope that it wouldn't lead me to a horror movie. You know, as opposed to that sort of that nihilistic, there's nothing you could do to avoid this awful thing happening, which seems to also be a thing that people like to do in horror films. But ultimately, the suspense works. It's got a great cast. The most recognizable people in it, you've got Alison Brie, whose character's married to Dan Stevens' character. So you see the two of them showing up in the movie. And so that adds to sort of the gravitas of it. So some of the other characters, the actors, you've seen the other two actors in things, but they're not as recognizable as Brie or Stevens. And they do good jobs and they balance it well. And one of the things that's a challenge with a movie like this is setting about getting the characters all set up, making them likable, but also making them flawed, but not feel like you're wasting 45 minutes to an hour of watching people you don't like. And I've said that before. Heck, I said that in the show today, that if I don't like the characters, it makes it very hard to like the movie. And in this sense, I thought the characters were recognizable, were relatable, and while they have their issues, I can see where they would be where they were, and it has a nice framework, kind of like where the story does go and where the reveals are work. It doesn't overdo the suspense to the point of getting boring, but it handles it really well. I mean, I think Franco does a fantastic job in this. I'm looking forward to seeing more stuff. It's maybe not as strong of a debut as like Jordan Peele did with Get Out, but it certainly is noticeable. So good for him. I'm going to say The Rental totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is Baby Splitters. Don't worry, it's not about people cutting up babies or anything. That's horrifying. Anyways, two couples who don't want the full responsibility of being parents cook up an agreement in which they will get pregnant and then share the child.
What if we could split a baby? Half a share in one baby.
But I would want the whole pregnancy to myself.
I'd only want to do it if it was my kid genetically.
You guys are actually serious about this?
Here's to two couples, one baby, and no regrets.
Cheers.
You'll never regret having kids. IVF costs $35,000 per attempt. Usually doesn't take more than a couple tries.
Natural donor insemination.
It's just what it sounds like.
It would have to be clinical.
Yeah, like a medical procedure.
this is one of those sort of modern rom-coms that tries to break out of what the rom-com formula is. There's a romantic comedy formula that's kind of been tried and true since the 80s. There was this romantic comedy that you had in the 40s and 50s, you know, sort of like those light comedies. And even into the 60s, you had stuff like Pillow Talk, you know, that the Doris Day kind of movies. But in the 80s, you developed that modern romantic comedy, the Reese Witherspoon, Julia Roberts, Sandra Bullock, Drew Barrymore kind of romantic comedy, and it really galvanized itself through the 90s. And they still make those movies. They're fine. They're cute. I like them. I happen to be a big fan of romantic comedies. This is one of those modern romantic comedies that try to be a little edgier. And those rub me a little bit the wrong way because they annoy me. And like the whole setup of this is Danny Pudi's one of the stars of it. He's from Community. He played Abed. And the movie starts off with he and his wife having sex, and they get into a baby discussion, and it goes on all the cliches of, oh, it's going to ruin my life. I want to have my free time. I want to be able to go drink. I want to go able to do this. And I have never had a whole lot of tolerance for that kind of stuff. Cause I'm like, don't be such a baby yourself. I mean, fine, live your 20s, do that thing. And then if you want to settle down, but this idea of I want kids, but when I'm older, I think is an immature way of looking at it. And it falls into the trap of looking at other people with kids and saying, oh, isn't this horrible? Isn't it how they do it? But it's also coming at it from that overly restricted LA-based sort of thing where you're looking at the fact that they're having kids, but you're watching the kids doing stupid things, like the whole thing where they won't say no to the kids and they won't discipline the kids and the kids can do whatever they want to. And I'm like, well, yeah, if you've got annoying people like that being parents, I would avoid them because their kids are going to grow up horrible. So that rubs me the wrong way. Partly as a parent, I have three kids. I've raised three kids. I spent a good chunk of my years taking care of them and raising them. And so I find this, the dismissal of this and the looking down your snout at this sort of thing to be kind of crass and kind of Luddite and stupid. I guess I'm past that. So to me, I never had that. I would have a discussion. I remember having a discussion with my wife saying, you know, it's one thing to plan to have kids because you think you're ready, but if we have a kid, great, the kid's going to come along for the ride. And that's kind of how our life was. And then on top of it, this idea, I think they try to make the idea work too well. It's an absurd, stupid premise. My wife was walking through the room when I was watching and she goes, well, wait, isn't this the same thing that people go through when they break up and have a different relationship? And I'm like, yeah, you know, this is not like a unique situation because people co-parent all the time. But to dive into that, the amount of decisions you make as a parent on a daily basis, you're going to get in an argument. I mean, I have family members who have kids and I love, I've babysit the kids and everything, but I wouldn't be able to co-parent with them. We'd go insane, you know, because their views and values and ideas of everything from cloth versus disposable diapers to should you allow them to have goldfish or are there too many dyes in it? I wouldn't be able to handle. And it just ignores how stupid it is from the beginning and tries to make it too relatable. Whereas it probably would have been better to show them in a terrible situation and go, how do we get here? Oh, we're idiots. And then you can laugh at how stupid they are through the beginning of the movie, but it doesn't work out that way. So I don't know. It just annoyed me. Maybe it'll make more sense to people who don't have kids. So anyways, I gotta say, Baby Splitters kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Scoob and a look back at the original Poltergeist.
She complicated. Where are you? We got some work to do now. Scooby Dooby Doo, where are you?
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. As a lot of people know who followed me or go on my Twitter, you know that I will live tweet movies. And I used to do that every week. I used to do for several years and I got away from it several years ago. Well, during the lockdown back this spring, I got in touch with a lot of my friends who I used to live tweet movies with. And I said, hey, let's live tweet some movies again. Let's do that. Because, you know, back then, especially during the lockdown, a lot of my friends were in New York that I do this with. I had one in Texas. I had one in San Francisco. And so I said, we're all stuck at home on a Saturday night. Let's start live tweeting stuff. And we went back and we like live tweeted Tron, a bunch of stuff we went through on the Disney Plus service. And it's been a nice way to sort of sound off and have a little bit of fun. But it is kind of nice going back and watching the old blockbusters, because we don't get the big blockbusters right now. All of those have moved, as we talked about in the first segment. So I want to take you all the way back to the summer of 1982 and talk about Tobe Hooper's Poltergeist, which, if you remember, this is an early Amblin movie. I mean, Amblin was founded in the early 70s, and it was just basically Steven Spielberg's production company. But it didn't become known as an Amblin movie until the 80s. And by the time you got to the mid to late 80s, when you say Amblin, you got a certain feel to it. And that's why when you watch a show like Stranger Things, you're like, oh, it's completely mining the Amblin experience. You know what it was like as a kid in the 80s, you're riding your bike around, because, you know, that's how it was with E.T. and the Goonies, and TV series like Stranger Things mines that Amblin feeling. The new Ghostbusters is going to have that Amblin feeling. If you remember the movie Super 8, which itself is an Amblin movie, is calling back to a lot of the Amblin elements. So I wanted to revisit Poltergeist. Tobe Hooper directs this big budget film about a poltergeist haunting a home in an idyllic California suburb.
They're here.
Sweetie, remember last night? Do you remember when you woke up and you said you were here?
Uh-huh.
Well, who did you mean? Who's here?
TV people.
I don't know whatever's over this house. I've never sensed anything like it.
That thing is in there with my baby.
They're hungry.
What's happening?
The reason this was a big deal is when you go back and you watch it, it really doubles and triples down on the special effects. Back in the 70s, which pretty much led up to this. I mean, they started making this movie in the early 80s, but pretty much 70s and earlier, if it was a horror film, it was a ghost story, it could be lower budget. And even you go back and you look at some of the ghost stories in the 70s, they were not high budget films, you know, even into the 80s, you know, stuff like The Changeling, that kind of a movie. You know, Exorcist was, well, it was a little more than a ghost story, but that had a lot of effects, and that sort of stood out. I mean, you didn't have a movie like The Exorcist until Poltergeist, which is, you know, 9 years later trying to do The Exorcist. And the fact that they got Tobe Hooper to direct it, who was best known at the time for Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which is a highly violent movie. Well, really isn't, actually. There's not a whole lot of on-screen violence, but it's a disturbing movie with a lot of, let's just say, implied violence that gets under your skin. But Poltergeist is such a fascinating movie because it is that big budget version of high special effects for a ghost story. And that's odd. We normally don't see the ghost story given that treatment. So it is kind of cool to see the big budget special effects of this movie. And, you know, now looking back at it, you know, even now with something like The Conjuring, which is a ghost story series, and Insidious, we still don't have the big budget light shows that you have for this one. This one still seems a little bit big, but it really does work. It's a compelling movie. I remember not loving it as a kid. I might have been a little bit too young to see it. I was like 11. I never saw it until home video, because this is also something that's responsible for the PG-13 rating. Steven Spielberg is almost single-handedly responsible for it. Of course, most people think of Gremlins and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom as being the leaping pad for the PG-13 rating because they were such violent movies. But it started way back with Poltergeist. There's a scene where a guy literally rips his face off. And that was a PG movie. So I even remember my mom was all, she saw it with my sister. She was old enough to see it. And she complained about it, and they wouldn't let me see it. I was too young. I would have loved to have seen it. And I eventually saw it on video. And it's cool, but it does have all those Spielberg elements to it. A lot of staring, the music, the idyllic family in the California suburb. I mean, it's basically the same group of people from E.T., only instead of getting visited by an extraterrestrial, they got visited by a demon. So the movie itself really holds up. Some of it's corny, and some of it certainly is a sign of the time, but it does hold up as a scary, disturbing film. Everything from the effects, which still look pretty good. I mean, they really do look really good in some scenes, all the way from that to the explanation of where the ghosts are coming from. So it's been a long time since I've watched Poltergeist, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was a really well-done movie, and I forget how much of an impact it did have on setting that stage for Amblin in the future. It's available on Netflix right now if you do want to watch it. So I'm going to have to say Poltergeist totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on Scoob, or as I like to say, Scoob! Because it's an exclamation mark. Warner Brother reboots the ever-popular Scooby-Doo franchise with this origin story and crossover tale of Mystery Incorporated trying to stop Dick Dastardly.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Shaggy and Scooby were taken?
Yeah. This blue light came down from the sky and beamed them up.
I can't breathe.
I have to assume that if they were with their friends, they wouldn't have been kidnapped.
Okay.
Can you skip the emotional punishment?
What would some guy want with Scooby and Shaggy?
I don't know, but I'd like to shake the hand of whoever created this. And then, you know, throw that hand in prison for trying to kill our friends.
I have always loved Scooby-Doo. I remember watching it growing up as a kid. It was one of the staple programs because I didn't have cable as a kid, so I came home from school and I turn on the TV and our local, we just got an independent station, which ended up becoming a Fox affiliate, and they would play Scooby-Doo cartoons, and I'd watch those every day after school. And yeah, they're corny and they're stupid, and there's always a bad guy in a mask, which is, they never believe in ghosts, but they got a talking dog. Don't explain that to me. But I always enjoyed watching it. And what's funny is Scooby-Doo has existed for years. And I remember the franchise in the 70s, but I used to go to Kings Island. That's an amusement park near Cincinnati. And the Hanna-Barbera characters were all part of that. Yogi Bear and Scooby-Doo were like the biggest images that you saw there. And so Scooby-Doo is a huge part of my childhood. I remember watching it when it came out VOD earlier this year, and I enjoyed the heck out of it, part of it, the fact that it still stayed authentically Scooby-Doo. Some things they changed, obviously, you know, the animation had gotten way better, but they didn't change the characters. It's the same Freddy and Velma and Daphne and Shaggy that you had in the original series, and maybe a little bit modernized, but still a lot of fun, and they managed to give it a real-life Scooby-Doo feel to it. I mean, CGI real-life, and make it into a full movie, and Dick Dastardly is a great bad guy. It really flows, and on top of it, they do all these crossovers, not just Captain Caveman and Dino Mutt and the Blue Falcon, who are all in the movie, but other characters like Hong Kong Phooey and Grape Ape are alluded to in the background, and I think that's wonderful, because I used to love the crossover potential of Hanna-Barbera characters with stuff like Laugh Olympics and Wacky Races and that sort of thing, where you had all the characters come together. And that was a real 60s, 70s type thing. So that's original old school Hanna-Barbera. I love this Scooby-Doo version. I enjoy it. I think it's colorful and bright and exciting and fun, and it's worth checking out with your family. If you haven't seen it, you can get it now for a less expensive price to own online. It's like $20. You can get the Blu-ray, and that comes with special features, but the online version also comes with the same special features, but then it's not loaded with them, but it's got bloopers of the people doing the voices. It's got a little scene on how to draw Scooby-Doo, which is a nice in-depth discussion of what makes, it's not just, hey, do a circle line here and that. The guy goes through and explains why they're doing all the different parts of it. They look at the new characters and the villains, and then they have a little thing with puppies, which is cute and all, but that's throwaway. There's a bunch of deleted scenes. All the deleted scenes are in storyboard form. While there's some neat stuff in there, you know, it's still just storyboard deleted scenes. But still, I loved Scoob. I thought it was a great movie and a great way to recharge the Scooby-Doo franchise. I can't wait for the next one. So Scoob rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Also available this week on DVD and Blu-ray include Capone, Spartacus, A Marriage Story on Criterion, You Don't Know Me, and Castle Rock Season 2. And that's it for this week. I'll talk to you next week when I'll have some new on-demand and streaming releases. Until then, have a fat time at the movies and at home.